Hello, this is Guillermo del Toro, and you're listening to Out Now Podcast. Hello.
We are now recording. This is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and always, this is...
Bela Lugosi! No, it's Abe.
Abe, you're back again!
I am back!
Back for another one of these!
Yeah, I traveled back from 1959 to 1985. I don't really know the dates anymore.
They're not hard to know. I mean, one's 55, one's 85, and one's 2015.
Yeah.
Like, of dates to know in moviedom, that's not a hard one to remember.
I believe that it's October 5th, right?
No. I mean, the only one that's more easy to remember, I think, is probably 2001. Like, that's pretty much it.
That's the one about James Franco going into space, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Out Now is a film podcast where Dave and I discuss new movies weekly. However, every now and then we like to have these special bonus episodes, and this is just one of those. I have some real dangerous men here with me to talk about some movies. And, yeah, we've been doing these all month long so far. We've been having filmmaker spotlights focused on horror directors or, you know, people that are in the more... horror, thriller, sci-fi, fantasy kind of genre. Yeah. But yeah, we talked about Wes Craven, we talked about John Carpenter, and we talked about Guillermo del Toro last week. This week we have a threesome coming up here. Exactly.
Okay.
That's how I'm phrasing it. I'm sticking with that one.
Phrasing.
Three filmmakers and three guests. There you go.
That's a good
sequence.
Way to put it. Yeah, yeah. But we are we're gonna a complete sequence, some would say. But we're gonna focus on three filmmakers that are kind of all in the modern era that we're in with horror. We're gonna focus on the three W's: James Wan, Ty West, and Adam Wingard. James Wan, of course, known for the Saw series and The Conjuring. Ty West, known for smaller films like The House of the Devil and The Innkeepers. Adam Wingard, also known for You Are Next, The Guest, and the VHS films. We'll get into all their stuff, but yeah, that's the spotlight we're putting on to filmmakers this week. And joining me, as always, for these horror bonuses, we have from JoeBlow.com, it's Jimmy O.
I want to play a game.
From Starpulse. It's Jason Coleman.
Oh, he wants to play a game.
Are you? That was my slow burn, my Ty West slow burn.
Nice.
Jimmy talked over it, but it was there.
I did. I totally talked over it. I want to play a game. Just going to say that the whole time. Hashtag I want to play a game.
And from the Naptown Nerd and YSOBlue.com, it's Brandon Peters.
Hey, I'm ready to have a wonderful evening with you guys out west. I think this podcast will be a win, guard.
Nailed it.
Go west, young man.
So for those of you who are all sticking through all this obnoxiousness, we can move on. That is the plan for tonight. We are going to talk about the James Wan, Ty West, and Adam Wingard. I have my three favorite horror friends here to talk about these movies. Abe's joined on as well because he's seen a lot of these, surprisingly.
No, I haven't. I'm actually just here to chat with you guys.
He's done minimal homework, but he's ready to talk.
Yep. Abe's like, so Furious 7, James Wan.
Yeah, how about that guy?
But, I like that movie.
I mean, I guess we'll get to these directors individually, but I guess I have to ask, to kind of set this up. I mean, we live in this time period. We know where we are with kind of, you know, the filmmakers we have and whatnot. Is there a general theme you get or something you enjoy about what certain filmmakers are bringing to the genre these days?
Yeah, you know, I mean, for me, interesting about, you know, two of the filmmakers on this list, you know, Adam Wingard, I think for me definitely brings that sense of unpredictability to some of his movies, which whether the movie's good, bad, whatnot, I can always count on sort of an unpredictability to his movies. So I think, you know, for me, that was kind of, you know, some of the horror movies that are kind of out of nowhere and unpredictable. I love that. And of course, for Ty West, it's really the craftsmanship. It's the idea of bringing back you know, slow burns and really, you know, creating a mood and a tone, and, you know, which is what, you know, we talked about Carpenter, you know, he's really good at that kind of thing. And James Wan we'll get into.
Any other thoughts on kind of the modern horror filmmakers we have currently?
I mean, I think with the guys we're talking about today, they all seem to be of the generation that would be inspired by a lot of stuff I grew up with. So I can see I can understand a lot of their inspirations and in the work that they're doing and other films that they're wanting to be striving to be like. and it's kind of fun, and they kind of put their own spin on things, which is really cool.
What's interesting is that we somehow got three W directors for one thing, and all of them, like you guys have said, they all kind of reflect growing up with horror themselves and having, you know, things they want to take away from that to put in their own films. But they're all distinct. Like, they all have their own style. Like, I'm very happy that we were able to choose three filmmakers that very much feel like different filmmakers. They don't feel like the same guy, even, you know, if Ty West and Adam Wingard maybe have worked closer together than Juan, who seems to be kind of in a different ballpark altogether. But I mean, they all, like, their films, I could identify their films as them between the three of them. Like, none of them seem like one's cribbing from the other or one's taking the same themes and aesthetics or whatnot. So let's jump into it then. Let's get right in. Let's start alphabetically by last name. Let's start with James Wan, who of course made his first splash in 2004 with Saw, which led to a number of sequels as well as a start of a theme in the genre, which isn't quite fitting given that the film Saw is not necessarily a torture porn film in the way others that followed it would become, but it seems like Saw certainly gets lumped in. Yeah.
If the first Saw is torture porn, then you're going to have to throw Seven in with torture porn as well.
In terms of absolutely. Seeing the results of things rather than actually seeing the thing that's happened.
Right. And Saw, if Saw never had a sequel, would it go straight up in the horror section by general classifications? It'd be in like the mystery thriller section.
Would you say that's completely fair? I mean, because I get what you're saying for sure, but
I get mad when they throw stuff like Silence of the Lambs in there. I'm going off general thing. I think like Silence of the Lambs is a horror film. I think Seven's like a horror film, but they get thrown in like mystery thriller. And I think Saw is just a little bit more extreme version of those, but it's right up their alley. That's what they're wanting to be. Saw is like incredibly influenced by like Seven.
For sure.
Like, I feel like that's what it wants to be.
And I can see what you're saying there, where it's like it's pushed to 110%. It's pushed to 11, if you want to, like, in terms of like how you would compare that film to something like Seven, where Seven is certainly there's a mood there that it's very stark, very dark, very grisly, but you don't necessarily see things. Where Saw, at the end of it all, a guy does saw his leg off. Like, we don't yeah. That does happen in the movie. It is shown.
There's a hint of the beginning with a little bit of blood, but yeah, they're right. You don't see it.
So. Yeah, there's that. There's a chick digging into a guy's stomach to find a key or whatever. I mean, there is.
It doesn't really show that. It's implied. It's much like Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Which is also a horror movie. I mean, that is a mm-hmm. horror film though.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's. I mean, yeah, it is like the look of the Seven. It also looks like it's also resembles Dr. Fibes a bit too, with its villain and his agenda kind of is similar to that. It's like a more modern, bumped up version of that.
For sure. I'm not denying that I can lean around the ideas of how horror quotes sock falls into, but I do see where I would easily file this into a horror category before, you know, filing, I guess, Silence or Seven. I think it's, for me, it's less up for debate in the same way that that Seven or Silence of the Lambs is when it comes to, or even Sixth Sense for that matter, in terms of like filing what's a horror movie versus what's not a horror movie.
But those were also like studio productions. This is more like super independent.
But I mean,
it doesn't have some of those constraints of many hands being tied in there to make safe or whatever.
Well, I think that's where you have to give that where I would give that movie credit. What I liked about the film is they really do kind of, you know, they come at it from a very, you know, low budget style, you know, really, you know, trying to throw everything in there. And even, you know, I had watched a documentary recently, I'm sure Jimmy watched it too, where they talked about, you know, the style with which they shot the traps and stuff. And they just didn't have a lot of footage, so they kind of beefed it up with the shots and how it was designed. And I actually thought that was really creative. And it's funny because then they used that for all the other movies, but it wasn't like a Saw staple. It was just something that they did because they didn't have footage. So the one thing I do like about Saw is I have to respect, you know, James and Leigh for really, you know, you know, pulling rabbits out of a hat, you know, creating an interesting concept and really for no money creating something that was really quite effective. And they really did cast a lot of interesting actors in that movie. You know, you got Danny Glover and there's a lot of great actors in that movie. So I'm, you know, there's some good things.
There's a lot of great actors giving somewhat bad performances in that movie. That's what I would
say. I
like Glover in that movie. I think he was good.
Glover's great at playing old again. That's what he's very good at doing.
Well, I think
Elwes is really bad in that movie. And Lee Waddell is really bad.
Monica
Potter's terrible in it. The only person I like is Michael Emerson. Pre-lost Michael Emerson. I think he did. Right. And Tobin Bell, to an extent, I guess, because he, you know, sits there.
Shawnee Smith's pretty good.
Shawnee's
great. Yeah.
The thing
with that film, and I think even James Wan feels that way, is they had so little time and they had to just. It was like 1-2 takes. If you watch the documentary, it is really interesting how they literally had 1-2 takes. So he's like, yeah, we didn't get the best performances, unfortunately. So, but that still, I think it, in a weird sort of way, it kind of makes the film work better. It's just like, watch the original Night of the Living Dead. The performances aren't good. But there's something kind of, I don't know.
I can see there's certainly some staginess to some of the performances, but I think like Dwayne Jones is a strong lead in that film. I think he does a good job.
Okay, well, yeah, he does a good job. But there are a lot of questionable performances in it. And I think it kind of gives these films, a lot of these really, really low, Texas Chainsaw Massacre as well. Again, I think it gives them, I don't know, some kind of a little
character
grit.
Yeah,
character, absolutely.
Yeah, and the one thing with Salt Lake isn't like 95% of that was shot in one warehouse or the streets around that warehouse, and that's, I mean, pretty impressive too. Because you get to Saw 2, and there's this shot of Donnie Wahlberg and his son walking outside, and you're like, holy crap! Like someone pulled the curtains open on me because it looks really weird.
Right?
In the second movie, when you see like outside, like location shots, so.
which they rarely do again in the series. I think it's not till like it's like the 3D Saw where like the opening traps in broad daylight, where it's like, oh yeah, that's right, the sun exists in this film series.
And it's amazing that James Wan would direct a Fast and Furious movie when you look at the car chase that they shot. Yeah, they had no money in Saw, but man, that car chase is like top five worst car chases in cinema history.
We should probably backtrack a step to do you like Saw, because we didn't really ask that question to begin with.
I do.
And so
I
do. You do.
Oh, I love
Jimmy
Saw.
You do.
Yeah.
I feel like Jason is with me, where I don't think we like Saw. We might admire things about it, but we're not fans of the actual movie. Is that fair?
I'm definitely on board with Dion.
Yeah, I'm not a Saw.
See,
I am not a fan of the film.
It was the Friday the 13th.
The thing is,
I was happy to see something continue. Just keep going. Like I was kind of enjoying
When I first saw it, I actually had that same reaction. I was like, this is so overrated. This isn't very good, but it's one that has grown over on me, especially watching the sequels and seeing them get, you know, some really good ones to some really poor ones. Seeing it, I don't know, it's really grown on me, and it's actually become one of my favorites throughout the years.
Part of the joy is like the ludicrous nature of their strong continuity and watching how they like reach to tie things or retell things. It's humorous, it's fun, but it's also rewarding if you've been there for all of them, just to see the craziness and how they spin everything.
I actually ended up thinking that the second Saw film was much better, and it files under the kind of the Die Hard with a Vengeance category, where they went from an original screenplay that had nothing to do with Saw, and then they just slightly adapted it. And I actually felt that was a much tighter, much more interesting film. But I admire Saw, like you had said, for what it is. But it definitely isn't. You know, I'd be curious to know throughout these films what anybody thinks James Wan's signature style is throughout.
It's really
films.
The second one that laid the groundwork for what the rest would copy.
Yeah, Saw 2 is like Saw 2 is like the Lethal Weapon 2 of the series, where it's like
the look of it and everything else would copy. Like the first one stands alone big time, and then the rest of them, the second one like sets the stage for what everything else would copy.
Right.
It's the Darren Lynn Bousman touch, who's we're not talking about on this podcast. So, the thing I'll say about, because we got to move on because we have so much to talk about. But I mean, with Saw. The thing I take away most is that I really liked James Wan and Lee Wannell as filmmakers. Like I listened to the, because I certainly gave it a fair shake. I've watched Saw like three times in full, and one time was with the commentary. And the best thing I took away from the first Saw is that I really want to see Juan and Juan will succeed, because they seem like really cool Australian filmmakers that are coming up from nothing and really making something. Clearly that's paid off. Absolutely. Because one of them has directed one of the biggest films of all time, and the other is, you know, he's still making the Insidious movies, is just branching out on his own now, doing directing. I mean, these guys have certainly come a long way since, you know, 11 years ago when the first Saw came out. So,
well, James Wan should be a household name. I mean, he's directed one of the biggest films of all time. He's the only director, I think, to have two $40+ million opening weekends for two different films in 1 year. Like, that's incredible.
Yeah. He did The Conjuring's probably one of the most successful horror movies of all time. I mean, like,
Insidious is one of the most profitable. The Conjuring... Saw is one of the most profitable.
Absolutely.
It's based off their minimal budgets. Yeah.
It's crazy where this guy's not gone, because he makes money. Like, he's
it's all, I it's, say, it's, and he I think he also gets he's really, really good at. There's a lot of filmmakers that try to pay homage to some of the things that they grew up watching. He's really good at that. And making it his own. He's really good at taking Carnival Souls and making it his own. He's even in Saw, they have that little Black Christmas moment, which is so effective and so cool. And you know what I'm talking about, right, Brandon? I'm sure.
Black Christmas. Oh yeah. The closet.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And I think he's just become a stronger filmmaker. Right? I love watching his career. I love seeing where he's going. I think it's, and I, you know, honestly, The Conjuring is probably one of my favorite horror films in the last decade or so. It's really good.
And see, The Conjuring, I was very indifferent on. I don't really care about The Conjuring that much.
But I'll say The Conjuring, like, I wasn't huge on, but I mean, he directed the hell out of that movie.
Yeah, it's a very well-directed average
what
movie.
You think of it, like, he is crazy all over that, like, his touch is all over that thing.
But now, Brandon, what would you say again? What would you say is a signature style of James Wan as a filmmaker?
As a filmmaker,
style-wise, yeah.
Oh man,
he uses all those cool shots. He I love what he does with the camera. He's very much has a style. Just watch his movies. I mean, he moves the camera. He likes to go up. He likes to give these kind of grand. Big cool shots. He does this with every single film.
My takeaway of him as a filmmaker, what he kind of leaves an impression on me in terms of like what I see in his films, is that he's great with geography. Like I always know where everything is because of how he glides his camera around everywhere. It's not necessarily an unbroken take all the time, but I always feel like I know exactly where things are based off what his eye is telling me.
He went from dirty bathroom to mountainsides with cars. I mean, he's got, you know.
Yeah, I honestly, to me, it's when I watch one of his movies, I personally feel like I know I can tell what a James Wan movie is. Absolutely. If I'm watching his Fast and Furious, I can tell the difference between the others. Besides the fact,
yeah,
that
I mean, with the Furious 7, you could tell. I mean, it was a different hand, and it was his hand with like the stuff with like The Rock versus Statham, the way he used the camera in those fight scenes with twirling it around and following the person rather than the environment. Like, it just, that was something definitely that he brought to the table.
And you could
tell his own touch rather than what's his name? Justin Lin. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of this guy. I like the fact that he's still so grounded and he still seems to really enjoy making movies. He just does, and I think that's really infectious.
Jason, what movies do you like of James Wan, if any? No.
I mean, there's nothing I would give a full, strong... I mean, we'll get to The Conjuring and I'll tell you what the issues I had with the movie, but
his favorite,
but there really isn't... Well, yeah, it's interesting because the next two films, let's go into it. The next two films, you know, Dead Silence and Death Sentence, which I think we should just pair together.
I actually like those movies both more than some.
Really?
I actually like Dead Silence a little bit.
I think there's a construction and maybe possibly even a out of necessity quality that made Saw a hit. You know, I mean, it definitely had things that were really good and that deserved it, but I think there was a lot of fluke, especially when I watched that documentary. Dead Silence and Death Sentence, to me, feel like those guys trying to just do their own thing and do separate stories and are incredible failures, because Dead Silence is just not scary. It's got some creepy tropes or whatever, but it just, there's no signature style. And Death Sentence, you know, I was really excited about that one because Jimmy and I first met on the junket for
Death
Sentence.
That is where we met, yes, exactly.
Yeah. And we were they showed us footage, and the footage looked fantastic, and it was like, okay, I even talked to James at that point, and he said, you know, I'm going back to the old school Charles Bronson stuff, and that movie just doesn't touch on that at all. It's a mess.
You don't think it touches on it at all, really?
It's a mess. I'm a huge revenge thriller guy. Like, I even like Faster, and that had a lot of hot plot holes, but Death Sentence is terrible as a revenge film. It's really bad.
You like Faster?
Yeah, even Faster, I like better than Death Sentence.
You remember Faster is another question.
Oh, yeah, yeah. At least he was focused in that movie. There was just something about Death Sentence that was all over the place. And it felt, the Dead Silence felt the same way to me. Mm-hmm. Somebody who just was just throwing stuff at the wall and looking for it to stick. I do think once we go later with Insidious and The Conjuring, they do start to, you know, compact things a little bit and make the stories more interesting that we can follow. But those ones felt like just slapping a wall and see what sticks.
Well, I wonder how much of that was him and how much of that was the studio getting involved. I really do, because that happens a lot with the second film. They make a really cool little independent film. Suddenly they're onto the next film. It's a studio film. Oh, it's great. And it just ends up being a disaster because everyone's giving notes and everyone's kind of putting their hand into it.
Brandon, didn't you get to see an early screening of Dead Silence?
I saw a test screening before it had a title. And it was just called Silence when I saw it, but they weren't sold on it, and they let us write down what we thought the title should be.
What did you write?
And I also met Lee Whannell there because I made a mistake, because I wasn't supposed to, because when you're in the entertainment industry, you're not supposed to go to those. And I went. It said the new film from the director of Saw, and then they had their questionnaire person come to people online asking what brought them to it. And I said, I mixed up their names, and I said I was interested to see what Lee Whannell would do outside of Saw. And she goes, oh, you know he wrote you knew that he wrote this? And I was like, oh, because they didn't advertise it with him. And she was like, I was like, yeah. And she's like, oh. And I was like, okay. She's like, you know, we're doing a group after this movie to talk about it. Why don't you stay for that? And I was like, this is where they're going to try to blacklist me, because they're going to find out credentials and whatnot. But so then I'm sitting in my chair. I was with a friend of the show, Scott Mendelson, and I was sitting. He went to get popcorn, and she came up to me again, sat with me, chatted with me some more, asking what I did for a living. And I BS'd, and then she went away. And then she came back and she goes, hey, Brandon, this is Lee Whannell.
Wow.
Brandon says he was interested to see what he's like. Oh, hello. How you doing? And, you know, talked with him for a little bit, and then he went up and sat in a corner. And then I was like, I need to bolt from this movie the minute it ends. but the funny thing, the funny joke at the end of it was Scott Mendelson, on the title suggestion, wrote that the title should be Ventrilla Quest. the best jokes ever, because the movie is about ventriloquism dummies and stuff like that. So
what did you write? I'm curious. What did you write as the title?
I had, I think I wrote something stupid like some like horror for dummies or something like that.
I like it.
Yeah, I saw that, but that's the only time I've seen the film. I thought it was okay. I really liked Donnie Wahlberg in it. Yeah. And I thought, the cinematography was terrific on it.
Donnie Wahlberg's constantly using an electric razor in that movie. That's what I remember about Dead Silence.
It's pretty funny. I thought it was okay. I've not gone back to it. It's something I should go back to take a look at, but I never saw the finished film.
It's a better dummy movie than Annabelle, that's for damn sure.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, God. Annabelle was horrible. Hated that film.
Although I think Goosebumps is probably the best dummy movie I've seen in like 10 years. So there you go. Take that, Dead Silence.
It's better than Dumb and Dumber 2?
It's dumbtastic. You're right. Let's move
best
away.
Best ventriloquist movie, really quick, Magic. Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, that was a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
It's not dummy with Adrian Brody?
Nice.
Oh, and that's what Juan's kind of building off of in Dead Silence. That's what I think part of the inspiration was.
Oh, for sure, Magic.
Oh, sure. Of course.
Let's move on because we've got two other filmmakers to get to. We still have other films with James Wan. So let's get to Insidious, which made on the cheap, shot on red camera, made for $1.5 million. Looks like they just kind of went to a couple houses and got some stuff together, and it came out, I think, really good. I really like Insidious. I'm a huge fan of Insidious.
I'll tell you what, Insidious was one of the films that got me like back into really like hardcore horror. Like I kind of, you know, I never was away, but I wasn't just that into horror for a few years. But this one and one of them from Ty West really just pulled at my heartstrings, got me back. But I think the first half of Insidious is pretty damn scary.
It is.
Like, really scary. I agree. Movie. I agree.
And then it gets to the halfway point, and then it makes a decision to go in a direction that you either go with it or you're going to turn on the movie. I went with it. It's a bit sillier, a bit more adventurous, but I liked where it went. But the first half of that movie, well, man. Scary.
It's basically Carnival of Souls.
Is that in Poltergeist?
It's so
Poltergeist.
Poltergeist and Carnival of Souls. Which that's kind of his. He knows how to pick and choose from classic cult flicks.
Which, yeah, you don't need like a Poltergeist remake. You just have Insidious.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's a good thing we didn't get one of those.
Yeah. Insidious put a stop to that.
Right. I did have fun with Insidious. Obviously, there's some tropes and ludicrous moments and things, but I must admit, maybe out of all of them, actually, I would think that that would probably have to be my favorite because I did have the most fun with Insidious. So.
Yeah, I would say, of his horror films, I think it's weird to rank Furious 7 within his films.
Right.
But I would easily say Insidious is my favorite of his movies as far as these go. With that said, Insidious... I'm trying to recall this because I have a James Wan story as well that comes with Insidious because I was at a screening where he was in the Q&A and I think one of the guys from IGN was moderating it. And I know what Insidious was it Oren Peli, right? It's Oren Peli and Jason Blum.
Yes.
They came on to produce. So yep. I remember seeing the preview or seeing like the poster because I was trying to avoid previews at that point. It's just saying like from the guys that brought you Saw and the producers of Paranormal Activity. And when it came to that, I was like, I'm going to stop watching trailers for these movies. So I haven't watched trailers for a lot of the Jason Blum stuff that's been coming out just to kind of hopefully be a little more surprised because it really worked for me with Paranormal Activity. I was like, I don't know what I'm getting into. But I remember I was in the audience for Insidious after the screening, and I feel like I phrased the question poorly, but I knew what I was trying to go for because I got boos for my question. But it was it was along the lines of like – it was supposed to be like, how did you, Jason Wan, work with Blum and Oren Peli? Like, what did you guys do together to make this thing work? And I think it came out something more like, why did you call in Jason Blum and Oren Peli to help you out with this movie? Like, it made it sound like they needed to rescue Wan for some reason. And it just like it got these immediate boos. And then I like rephrased it slightly, and Wan was like, no, I get what you're saying. So it's like, Wan's a cool guy. I like him. The audience was a bunch of dicks, but still, I was happy. I really like like you said, Brandon, the first half is freaking scary. But I think my favorite thing about Insidious is that they actually move. That's the greatest. That's like the greatest like thing that they do in that movie. Is like, oh, this house is pretty scary. Let's get out of this house and go to a different one. And it's still scary. They move to the least scary looking house they could, just like somewhere in Pasadena or whatever. That's one story. No like gothic giant doors, like doors and large ceilings and all this stuff. It just looks like a good normal house, and it's still haunted. Little kids running around, singing Tiptoe Through the Tulips. It's great.
Well, yeah, you don't go to the entity's Barbara Hershey's house. If you're going to move out of a haunted house, you go there. No.
Yeah. But no, I am a big fan of Insidious, and yes, I understand the second half, or not even the second half, it's just like the last third of the movie, when it's like, oh yeah, there's a reason why this stuff is happening, and we have
we're going on a ghost adventure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This was another one I actually didn't really appreciate until a couple of viewings later, and then it grew on me because I was kind of bothered by the kind of shift in the middle, and I felt kind of it got a little goofy, but again it's grown on me throughout the years. I enjoy it quite a bit now.
What's funny also is it's a loud movie. And it's
all the Insidious movies
they print. Yeah,
the title screen is effing loud.
Yeah, I was gonna say the music.
But it's because the kind of thing where like yes, jump scares are not there's a cheapness to them, but I feel like in this movie in the Insidious movies in general, really, I feel like they earn those scares. Like, regardless of my thoughts on the other Insidious films, I feel like what it's something of a – it's a series staple that I don't mind at all. Like, I feel like it really works to this these films' advantage. Yeah? Anything else?
You're right.
Rose Byrne's really good in this movie. Okay. what else can I say?
Oh, she was.
Yeah.
Patrick Wilson, Rose Byrne, it's a good cast for on the cheap that they could get people like that.
And Lin Shaye, and then you have Lee Wannell and Angus Sampson as Specs and Tucker, the ghost hunters and all this stuff. Moving on then. Let's move on to The Conjuring, because I know there's people that really love The Conjuring, and I'm okay on The Conjuring. Jimmy, you really love The Conjuring. Jason, you're not as big on The Conjuring.
I love The Conjuring. Yeah, love it.
Jason, what do you...
I was going to have a say.
I'm just curious.
Sure. So, well, the thing I loved about The Conjuring is I love the Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga characters. I find that fascinating, that part. So following them, that's what to me made the movie interesting. But we followed them into a case that we've already seen. And so to me, the case was boring. I was interested in them. I wasn't interested in the case. And so that's what I'm half and half on the movie, because I almost either wanted to see a standalone story just dealing with them and how they became the way they did and all that good stuff, or dealing with a case that I hadn't already seen, because it's very Amityville horror-esque and we've kind of seen it. And so I'm actually more interested in seeing the Conjuring 2, because maybe we'll go into a case that we haven't seen. But I the problem I had with it was it didn't feel, because I mean, even the trailers lead with the two of them, because it's such a fascinating idea of the two of those characters, but they go into a case that I've seen, and I was kind of bored.
I think
that teaser was gangbusters, though, that they had.
It was, oh my God. It focused on them, though, because it was like, well, here's this couple, you know,
the teaser with the hand clap.
Yeah. Teaser is Lily Tomlin. Yeah. The teaser, which Lily Taylor. Sorry, I always say that wrong.
Here's what I have to say. I totally respect that, and it does feel like something we've seen before. Had it not been for Ron Livingston and Lily Taylor, and it wasn't over the top, the scares felt more genuine. The moment with the little girl pointing at the door, saying, terrified, what she's freaking out. It didn't show anything. It was beautiful. There was no CG. There was no monster coming out. I love that. And this one is one that I watch every year, every Halloween, because I just love the scares. They feel earned. And yes, the family's not that original, but there's something really terrifying because they feel real to me. They don't feel like some Hollywoodized, you know, family being possessed by the devil, which a lot of these films are possessed by demon or whatever. A lot of these films tend to do.
I have a couple problems with The Conjuring, because it's a movie I do like overall. I just don't love The Conjuring. But one is that teaser ruined the best thing about the movie for me, where I went in really excited because I'm like, oh, there's clearly going to be more of this type stuff, because that one scene from a teaser trailer was amazing with the clapping of the hands and everything. It's a fantastic, chilling little sequence. And nothing ever amounted to anything that's greater than that sequence to me. So it's like, well, I already saw that in the 2 minutes, you know, 7 months ago leading up to this film, and I don't have anything that tops that. The other thing was that I saw a panel for this movie at, I think it was WonderCon that year, and the producer, I think it was Peter Safran, he stood up there and he's like, oh, we got an R rating because they just said it was too scary. And that lured me in because, like,
It's a PG-13 movie, easily.
It is, but
it's
a very soft R, and they came up with this bullshit reason of it's too scary. That's why it's R, because it's just too scary. So that threw me off watching. It's like, really, this was too scary? Like, all right.
Well, was that on the MPAA description?
Yeah, it was something like first scare. I've talked to so many people that have watched that movie. Your average audience that loves that movie, and they find it terrifying. So I think there is some legitimacy to that. I really do.
I'm not one that gets like particularly scared these days about horror, because like, I've seen so many horror movies. It says sequences of disturbing violence. That's the rating, by the way. I do acknowledge that, you know, like a certain visceral quality in movies that I consider to be scarier than movies that like aren't that scary, like Insidious, for example. I do think that movie is genuinely scary, or movies that we'll get to in some of these other filmmakers' stuff. I think Ty West has some stuff that's really scary in it, like The Innkeepers, which is mostly a comedy for the most part. I think that movie has scary bits. But I think my other problem, I think, is that it I never feel like the family's in that much peril because I know that they're going to survive. Like, the movie tells me they're going to survive. And that bothers me. Like, I don't, there's not much going on that's like really going to surprise me in this movie because I pretty much know everyone's going to make it out okay, it seems.
Wait, does it say that? I don't remember.
It starts like
that.
It bookends with Lisa, like, all the daughters are like all alive and they talk about how like this crazy thing happened. Like, that's.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, like, the thing is with it, you know, we've seen this before, but this movie, the horror movies attract the teens who probably haven't seen the Amityville Horror. We're getting a point now where they didn't even live through the VHS boom of like getting 8 Amityville sequels, so it might not be familiar, or they don't want to watch the old movies because kids nowadays, I for the most part, don't like to go back and look at old films for some reason. And then there's the adults
that don't
remember it or aren't interested in watching it and find it hokey and stuff. They don't know how to watch an old movie, and so it is kind of fresh.
Right.
Done.
Well, I found myself more interested even in the Annabelle section of the movie because it's just.
Well,
the
house is creepy. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, that's a great story, and I want to know more about that couple.
You sure
so,
got it though.
Yeah. No. Unfortunately, that didn't mean I wanted a whole movie. You know.
You got what you
asked. Yeah. It was not. That was even
worse. Yeah.
Which is, I mean, that's actually another problem I have where it's like. Like suddenly the focus goes to this other stuff, and it's like it just feels like it's kind of spastic in terms of what story it wants to tell. Where I do agree, the Warrens, I find them to be interesting characters, and what does excite me about Conjuring 2 is the fact that everyone is involved again. It's not just like a cheap sequel they're making a couple years later. Like I don't know what the Last Exorcism sequel or whatever. Like it feels like you've got Juan back, and you've got the same. It's not the same writers, but is it the same writers? Wait, is it? No, it's not. But you've got the same director in play, which I think is always a good thing. And it is involving the Warrens again. It's involving the characters that were the most interesting. So ideally, right.
It's also a decent. My thing is, I still feel The Conjuring is a more adult horror film. I really do, and I'm hopefully with the sequel, you have Francis O'Connor, who's terrific. So that's one thing he gets right is the casting. I mean, Patrick Wilson and Vera are just phenomenal
in that movie.
Great.
Yeah, and hopefully, listen. I mean, those guys, the real couple had been doing it for years, so they've got to have some other stories that are fascinating and interesting. So I'm just hoping to get an interesting story that I haven't seen kind of a million times that can feature those two.
Then don't watch the. Well, it's called. I mean, according to this, it's called the Enfield Poltergeist, which is actually right. they have a TV movie on right now called the Enfield Poltergeist
to cash in.
So, yeah. There you go.
Is there? I mean, I we're not going to talk about Furious 7. I'm just going to put that right there now. I mean,
no,
there's no reason to talk about Furious 7. Insidious 2, though, did happen.
We did a whole one on that.
Yeah. which is mainly I'm just gonna because we have to deal to talk to other filmmakers. I'm just gonna divert to that podcast. You can hear more of what you can hear more of why Jimmy's an insane person that liked Insidious 2 while Jason, Abe, and I were like, what? And like in that podcast.
It made a lot of money. So clearly it must be good.
Oh wow.
Do you guys remember after Insidious 2, Juan said he was
just
done
like
with
Jurassic
horror.
World.
Do you remember Juan saying he was done with horror after Insidious 2? I'm not going back. And then Furious 7 happened, and he's directing Conjuring 2 and producing horror movies.
Well, what was weird is that
I would guarantee you people stuff all the time. And it's like, you know, it's like we go through life every day. We'll say, oh, I'd never see one of those movies again. I'll never do this again. But because it's in print, everyone's like, oh my God, well, he said that. He's a liar. It's just, it kind of gets ridiculous.
Well, I mean, he was also saying that, like, he didn't want to be in horror in the first place. But yeah, he's one of the most prominent directors in the genre and most successful. So, I mean, I get maybe wanting to branch off and stuff. But
yeah.
I'm glad he's back, too. Yeah. I felt like you shouldn't close that door. But you know, never say never.
Yeah,
you know, he said all at once, but now he's back. He's doing a sequel.
Unless you're Romeo Void, then you say never all the time. You make a song about it.
The weird thing is that was that the news about Conjuring 2 came out before Furious 7 happened, which started making people wonder: is Furious 7 not tracking well, or is the testing screenings going bad? Obviously, that was not the case.
wait! Did Furious 7 do well?
Did okay. So anyway. Let's move on now. Let's get to our second filmmaker here. We got Ty West.
T.I.
T.I. himself.
T.I.
He's only put together a few films so far, and it's kind of jumped into acting a little bit too with Joe Swanberg. Him and Drinking Buddies is hilarious. Let alone your next. We'll get there though with Wingard.
I'll tell you what. I have to thank this man. If I ever met him, I would thank the hell out of the man, because with House of the Devil is the first film I saw from him.
And yeah, so good.
That movie, I didn't know much about it going in. Just I heard a lot of buzz about it, and I was in the dark. It was a late night. I popped it on. And that movie transported me back to my childhood self, on a Saturday night, renting a VHS from, the movie store. My parents were asleep and watching a scary movie. And then, I got into the suspense of the film. It was dark. And that was an amazing experience. It takes a lot to do that after watching horror movies for, decades. And then going back to that. So that was an amazing experience. And he made that movie. You could pop that on and convince someone that 80s movie. He does no winking.
Oh, absolutely.
No winking, saying, ha ha, we're doing this. And he essentially did what the artist did, and they won an Oscar for it.
Yeah.
He made a film of its era and didn't wink. The artist winked. He doesn't wink. It's an amazing feat if you
it
look
commits.
At all that. For how low budget it is, they were repaneling walls in restaurants and trying to make everything look legit, and it just does. His camera movements work. The acting, he cast an actress that looks like that Margot Kidder type, Jocelyn Donahue.
Yeah, Jocelyn Donahue. Yeah.
Jocelyn Donahue, mm-hmm. who of course played the young Barbara Hershey in your Insidious, which I told you at the time, I was I'm a big fan of hers.
She's great. She's great.
That, yeah, that the of that era. There, the girl from Raiders of the Lost Ark, that type of actress. So, and
Karen Allen.
Yes. So it just worked for me so well. And it's so cool to see something like that done really well. And there's been a bunch of others that, want to be that since then. They just don't get it. They look, there's too much modern about them, even though they're trying to be that way. But this is the one, this is the golden standard for making a nostalgia movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a real comfortability in Ty West's work. When I first reviewed this movie, I definitely had some issues with it in terms of some of the pacing and payoff and stuff. But it's definitely one of those films, for Jimmy, that kind of grew on me the more I watched it. I always felt there was not only a signature style with Ty, but that there was an effortlessness. Especially in capturing the 80s, it never felt like he was forcing it down your throat. It just felt like it was shot then. So there's a real comfortability factor in the work that he does. And what you said, from the look to the casting, you got Tom Noonan in there and Mary Warnoff. And you really that's great. You really do have to, even if, whether you like it, don't like it, think it's okay, you really do have to respect Ty West, I think, as a director. And it even in the indifference parts, it made me go, I'm going to watch whatever he does next.
Yeah, what's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I easily fell for this style. It's hard for me to be like... I do recommend House of the Devil and The Innkeepers. I do say check them out just because I'm curious what people will think of them. But I just so responded to the fact that there's so much just deadness of what's happening. Where you I'm accustomed to seeing certain things play out in a certain way so much that it was so refreshing to watch this movie where you just follow Jocelyn Dottie. You follow Samantha's name in the movie. You follow her throughout this. It's just staying in this house for a good long while with nothing happening, and you think something
nothing
might happen
to do.
But there's not, it's just her walking around, listening to her the Walkman. Is it a Walkman, right? She has a Walkman on.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. She's just doing her thing, and you think any second something's gonna come around the corner and fuck this shit up for her. But just nothing goes on. You get a sense of danger right away because Greta Gerwig encounters something that doesn't...
A.J. Bowen.
Yeah, she encounters A.J. Bowen.
A.J. Bowen is the man. That guy is so good in everything he does.
And it's just... I'm completely into the style of Ty West, which I think carries over very well to The Innkeepers, his next film.
Absolutely, yeah.
Does it? But yeah. Real quick,
you know what?
Seen,
really quickly, yeah. I have seen The Roost. I really love this movie. I own The Roost. It's a really cool little kind of vampire-y, like I dug this movie. It was another one. It felt really old fashioned and. I highly recommend it if you haven't. You know, I'm looking at its IMDb. It's got 4.9, which clearly means it's good. I actually dug it. It's flawed, don't get me wrong, but it's one of those, great cast. Larry Fessenden is in it for a brief second, and it's just so much fun. I knew from seeing this film, I was like, this guy's really good.
And it seems
then
like
I saw House of the Devil, and
have you seen,
I was hooked.
Trigger Man?
That one I have not.
No, that was a pretty cool little thriller in the woods with guys. It's not great or anything, but it's a very interesting watch. And he's, you know, still that got that thing that makes you like, man, this guy's got something. He's got some talent.
Larry Fessenden.
We don't need to talk about Cabin Fever 2 because even he doesn't
like
that
movie.
He deserves that. But
I don't know why.
But The House of the Devil and then The Innkeepers, I think it's just a great one-two punch of a filmmaker.
We found two actors with incredible chemistry in The Innkeepers.
Yeah, Sarah Paxton and Pat Healy are wonderful in this movie. They play these two that are basically looking after this the Yankee Peddler, right? It's this old grand hotel and it's now closing and they're kind of on the last shifts of like the week, and it's ostensibly it's like a buddy comedy. It just happens to be a ghost story as well. And mm-hmm. while there's more humor in it, it's still a lot of like waiting around for something to happen. And not that I'm necessarily saying like, man, something needs to happen right away, but I'm just so comfortable watching these people act in these movies. And I'm very happy with that, with the amount of tension that I know is building, because I know it is a horror movie. So it's like, something needs to happen at some point, but I'm just so curious because of the way he kind of builds this world and these characters that exist in it.
There's moments of chill factor that don't require a jump scare. And I think that's what makes The Innkeepers, you know, in between the humor so great. And Sarah Paxton, listen, she had done a lot of heavy stuff up to that point. So it was interesting that she was like, I've never usually offered these kind of things. Because she was very, again, what you're talking about, the chemistry between the two, very natural. And ever since that movie, I've watched anything Pat Healy's in. And I spot him right away, in Captain America, he had a little scene in that. Or, you know, I'm a huge Pat Healy fan. But
he was on Ray Donovan this season, too. He's pretty
nice.
Oh, wow.
And he's just around LA a lot in general, because I see him all the time.
Well, him and Sarah Paxton got back together in Cheap Thrills. That was a terrific
Cheap Thrills,
movie.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Oh, yeah. Good flick.
But Sarah Paxton, by the way, was the star of the Last House on the Left remake that we talked about.
Right.
Last Craven Show.
Right.
Which I liked her in that, too.
And then a great little, you know, piece of not only piece of casting, but great character that he took off of that I remember Ty telling me that he took off of House of the Devil, which was the Dee Wallace, who he had worked with on House of the Devil, was into, you know, psychic stuff and stones and runes and things like that. And so he wrote that character with kind of her in mind, but didn't want her to play it. And then, of course, he got Kelly McGillis to play it. So it added just another slight level of creepiness. There's Innkeepers feels even more accomplished to me than House of the Devil, really just, you know, layering the next layer.
You mentioned that it doesn't rely on jump scares at all. Like there's things where like, hey, things are getting heavy here. There's like a scene in early, midway through that movie where a reveal happens and it's terrifying. Like it's really scary where she's like in a room and suddenly there's something else in that room. And the way it like happens, it's not a quick like, boo, I gotcha. It's like a gradual thing that happens and you just kind of, you realize exactly as she realizes what's going on. It's like, this is not supposed to be here. And she runs out of the room and it's terrifying. It's just stuff like that, I think, really works well in his movies. That's why I was, it's funny because I was really looking forward to The Sacrament based off these two movies. And it's completely different from both of these movies.
Right.
Which we should get to right after we get to VHS, which he has a small segment in, which is, I'm trying to remember the segments of the first VHS, but I know he does this.
The one where the bros go out and pick up the girl. And
no,
second
honeymoon.
That's different,
was
right?
Well, no. You were trying to remember the other segments, I thought you said, and I was trying to. Is that what you meant, Aaron?
Yes. That's what I meant.
Okay.
I'll try to remember
the
other.
I know which one Ty West did, but there's There's that one. There's
the one. There's the one where there's a succubus.
So yeah, that's the one with the women. And then I remember Ty West.
And then there's
I just remember there were too many in VHS one.
Yeah, it's really
it's
long.
Like five,
yes, so there's one where it's like a slasher movie, but it's really weird because it's like the slasher's messing up the camera, so like you can't see anything. They're like in the woods. Then there's the last. There's one on Skype. That's the Joe Swanberg one where there's
is
weird
the one
stuff.
With the, is that the one that has the guy with the GoPro and the zombies?
That's the second one.
That's the second VHS.
That's
okay.
The second one, yeah. Which I think
And then the last one, the first VHS, is like it's Halloween and they go into this house and crazy stuff's happening. But no, Ty West's one is like it's the simplest for a movie called VHS. That's very simple to begin with, yeah. And it has my problem with the first VHS is that beyond it being too long, is it's really mean. Like every single character is like super douchey in that movie, like. Ridiculously so, and that his one is it's very much Ty West style where there's nothing happening until like the last moment, but then things do happen and it's like, oh, that's surprising and shocking, but at least the characters involving are not like insane assholes like everybody else in every one of these other in the other shorts.
Well, I think that's the point of that first one though.
Well, the first, like, it's the first.
Are you supposed to like those guys?
Well,
like,
no, but even the wraparounds are like just nasty, terrible and stuff, like there's so much going on, but no, I really like White West segment. I remember walking away thinking that was frightening in terms of just how simple it is, because it doesn't involve any supernatural stuff. It's just like
it's pretty dark. Yeah,
it's just a terrible thing that happens. But moving on, let's get to the sacrament.
Wait, but before that, let me just also say that, you know, that the great thing about House of the Devil and The Innkeepers is that he did those with Dark Sky Films, and they released special edition lush stuff. So House of the Devil got a clamshell VHS.
Oh, yeah.
And the Innkeepers got that LP with like a one sheet on one side and a Blu-ray on the other. So I wish they'd keep that going, because that did some really cool stuff, like a packaging for those two movies.
Yeah, they get that, because he's a huge film fan in general, which should go without saying, but he's a guy that really does like to delve into media and like provide his own like thoughts and stuff on there. There's a lot of like he does a lot of trailer commentaries. I know that for sure.
Yeah.
He likes being involved in that side of the production as well. Let's see. He also had a short in ABCs of Death, which I really can't remember honestly, because that's what happens when you watch.
No, I can't. I didn't see that one.
That's what happens when there's two ABCs of Death and you watch 52 different short films. It becomes a little hard to remember which one's which.
I do want to say though, for the sacrament, just so you know that the you know how IMDb rates that it's gone down. It's 3,666. I think that's perfect.
Okay.
Number of the beast. I'm sorry, that fascinates me, and I haven't seen Sacrament, so you guys gotta go. Yeah, I did. I haven't gotten to this one yet. I wanted to watch it before, but I've been, you know, I have a life.
Just it did not. Kidding. It did not get a cool special edition like the other two.
No, it didn't.
Just got basic release, but it's. I was kind of like, oh, he's doing a found footage movie, but
I didn't know what it was going in.
It's not so much found footage as like. Just like the coverage is like they just want you to be there with these guys as much as you can.
It's a mockumentary. It's a Vice documentary. Yeah. That's what it's supposed to be. Right. It's in the guise of a Vice documentary. But I mean, it's like a mockumentary essentially. That's what it is. I mean, it's weird when you say mockumentary because you kind of think it inherently implies comedy, but it's not comedy. I mean, I think it's just the way to describe that. It's a pseudo documentary.
And it's not. I mean, it's one that just gets under your skin.
It's another one where, like, even though it is a completely different kind of film format, it is very much a Ty West movie as far as nothing's happening for a lot of it before things go crazy. And when things go crazy in this movie, they get really crazy. But the things that I think really hold it together is the casting this time around, where you have you have A.J. Bowen, Joe Swanberg, who's fantastic in this movie, and Amy Simons, and then Gene Jones as this leader of this cult that they're all investigating.
Yeah, that was a nice little inspired piece of casting, definitely, because you got to have somebody who's going to hold that interest and who's going to supposedly lead the group. So,
Gene Jones, who you don't know offhand when I say the name Gene Jones, you probably best know him as the man in No Country for Old Men who Anton Chigurh challenges with the first coin flip when he talks about the quarter. And you don't this is the kind of the first time you're really hearing Chigurh talk about his philosophies on what it means to. Kind of, you know, bet your life on a coin flip, that kind of thing. He's the gas station attendant that he's, you know, threatening his life with, essentially. That's That's the best way I can point out that character. But he makes a hell of a charismatic cult leader in this movie.
But yeah, you know, I mean, listen, I mean, if anybody's going to make me appreciate or sit through whatever you want to call it, a found footage movie or whatever, because I admit I was a little disappointed initially hearing that too. It's definitely Ty West, and I agree. It's definitely feels like his movie, but it did. I'd be lying if I didn't say that it made me miss the kind of accomplished visual look of the way of a Ty West movie. So I mean, it definitely transcended that genre, which I usually hate, and it made me like that movie a whole lot more than I would have if anybody else had directed it. But I still feel like Ty really accomplished something in those two movies, in House of the Devil and The Innkeepers, that visually is a signature style. So I'd be lying if I didn't say it didn't affect me a little bit, but not enough to not think it wasn't a great movie.
Of these three, I would easily say yes. I'm not as big a fan of The Sacrament as I am of House of the Devil and The Innkeepers. I don't own The Sacrament where I own The Innkeepers and House of the Devil, but right. I do think it is a solid take on this type of movie. But that and I really, I mean, as much as, you know, I really love the lead ups in his films, the payoff is pretty crazy. I mean, given the kind of the scope of things going on when you have a commune that
gets
into stuff that you kind of associate with cults that are on the darker sides of things, to put it lightly.
I mean, the whole movie, you're sitting there going, I don't trust this place, but why? Why do I not trust this place? Why do I not trust? And just waiting on that delivery.
So, yeah, I know he has another film. I think it's in the works. What's it called here? What do I got?
In the Valley of Violence, which is a revenge Western. And I don't even care, you know, like that seems to me like not only, I mean, any revenge Western, whatever, anything Ty West does, I'd watch. But that one especially, it seems like that he might, you know, visually might go back to that kind of the beautiful visual scope. So anything Ty West does, I would definitely go see.
I see here it's shot on 35.
So nice. It's gonna look great.
It's a Western, so
and it has Larry Fessenden in it. You guys don't realize Larry Fessenden's a big deal in indie horror. Come on,
he's got a box set.
Of a big deal. Yeah, he's got a box set. Come on,
it stars Ethan Hawke, John Travolta, and Ziggy from The Wire. So I mean, those three things right there.
Aaron Gillen, Tyrese Farmiga. This is a great cast.
There's other people there too. I just want to say Ziggy from The Wire.
James
Ransom. I like that guy.
Do you guys remember the movie he was supposed to do called The Side Effect with Liv Tyler?
No.
Nope.
It was like announced years ago, and it was him and Liv Tyler, and she was going to play this like woman in space, like on some experiment, and she finds out she's pregnant or something. Kind of weird. Mm. Like it was a big deal in like trades and stuff, and then nothing came of it. I mean, it's not even here on his IMDb page.
Isn't that that sounds like the Halle Berry TV show? He's like in space and gets pregnant.
Yeah.
No, I'm not kidding. Isn't that the basic premise of that show?
I have no idea.
I
avoided that one.
Maybe that's why.
but interesting last thought on him. You know, I think it's interesting that all of us have kind of ups, downs, things that we like, don't necessarily like, whatever, in his films. But I think all of us agree that there's a real interesting signature style, a potential, and just a real throwback to some, you know, a real ease in his filmmaking that makes us keep coming back and watching his movies. So I'm a Ty West fan.
How about his acting? I always find it funny when he's in.
Well, I never think it's a problem because of his acting, though. I think it's just more of because you know it's Ty West, and you're like, well, this is fun that he's here. Like, I'm not gonna say that he's, you know, upstaging Anna Kendrick and Drinking Buddies or something like that. But I mean, it's just like, oh, Ty West is also here. But I think in your next, which
I like the fact that they do that. I like the fact that they kind of switch off with each other. Yeah. I think it's fun to watch.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they throw is Ty West one of the quote unquote mumblecore people? Because I've seen him getting thrown in there, and I've never thought that once when watching one of his movies.
It doesn't make any sense because everything he does is very deliberate. Where mumblecore is like suit of your pants, like, we got a cardboard box. Let's throw that in the scene. Do you have any lines of dialogue to talk about it? No. Well, just talk about the cardboard box. That's my point.
But he's collaborating with a lot of the people that are in.
He happens to be. He's friends with them. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Guilty by association.
He's not. I guess so. But his films are. they're decidedly not mumblecore. They're not gorecore.
No, not
whatever that one is. Like they're none of that.
Splatter? What is it? Splatterpunk? Yeah.
Splatpack?
Not that. Not that at all.
No, he's marching to the beat of his own drum, I think. I think he, you know, if anything, it just seems like he's a friendly guy because he seems to be friends with a lot of these people. But, like, I'm certainly not thinking of him as, like, man, look at all that improv scenes that he did to make it look like the 80s and, like, have characters speaking a very specific way. Like, Tom Noonan's not rocking on no set with no script to kind of make up stuff. Like, that's not...
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's move on then. Let's move on to our final filmmaker, Adam Wingard, who's only got a few films here.
A Horrible Way to Die.
Yeah, there's shorts and, yeah, Horrible Way to Die.
Where do we start? Do we start with Homesick? Have any of you seen that?
I've seen Homesick. It's a small indie, you know, low budget, you can feel it kind of movie. I mean, it's got Bill Moseley. Bill Moseley's got a good scene in it where he's kind of, I mean, he's playing his traditional wacko thing and he's threatening Tiffany Shepis. And I mean, I think you kind of get the gist of it. You know, I mean, it's okay. It's not great. Little Bill Moseley weirdo action and that's it. So.
We got Popskull. We got a Horrible Way to Die, which I happen to know Jason is a big fan.
I am. I love A Horrible Way to Die. And that, you know, that I think that for me was one of the first movies that I remember. You know, I mean, AJ, what's interesting is that you were talking about AJ Bowen. AJ Bowen, I remember meeting on the set of Hatchet 2. And he was just a really nice guy, and he was hanging out. He wasn't even working that day, and he was just helping out the production. He just seemed like a really nice guy, and I remember watching A Horrible Way to Die and thinking, wow, this is a really, really good performance. And so I interviewed him for it, and he was just like, oh, you have bad taste. But he's a very humble guy, very interesting. But I think of all the work that I've seen AJ do, that is my favorite. It's very minimalist. He's kind of playing a sullen serial killer. I like the style of A Horrible Way to Die, and I thought AJ Bowen was friggin' fantastic in that movie.
I have nothing to add. I haven't seen A Horrible Way to Die. I wanted to.
Ah.
I got around. I did. I wasn't a fan when I first saw it, and I don't know. It's one I've thought about revisiting just because Jason is such a big fan. For some reason, it just felt kind of icky to me. I didn't feel like it wasn't. You know, sometimes you watch a movie, and we see a lot of horror movies, and a lot of them are very dark, and a lot. There's something about that that didn't sit well with me, and I liked AJ and I liked the performances, but something just didn't work for me. It's one I do plan on revisiting, hopefully, maybe one day.
I think it's I think it's worth it just for AJ's work, even alone.
I also think one thing it did for me personally, like I like really didn't like Joe Swanberg, man. I think it did a good job of like painting such a villain with him. I was just so mad at him for that.
That you hated watching his movies because you're like, oh, he's an evil guy. Yeah. But I like this.
Yeah. No, it's just like, I mean, it made it like he was a tough pill to swallow for like the next film you see him in or whatever. But
right.
I think it was really effective. And I don't know if that's on Wingard or if it's on Swanberg or both, but I thought it was a really good turn on the villain. And Simons is great as always. I don't think I've seen her poor in anything.
You're a big Amy Simons fan.
I am.
I guess we have the VHS films, which are these like his like I know he's only directed like some of the shorts, but these seem like they're like his babies. It seems like, right?
He's like, one of the like driving forces behind. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd have to agree, and I'd have to agree with Aaron. I VHS 2 to me felt a lot funner than
it's way better, easily.
Yeah.
That's
just
it.
The cult one alone is just outstanding.
Safe Heaven from Gareth Evans, who directed The Raid and The Raid 2. It's kind of a masterpiece of
it's
short
a thing
horror
of nightmares,
filmmaking.
Man. Yeah. It's
of short horror filmmaking. It's pretty incredible.
You're next, correct?
I'm not skipping I'm going by wide release. Because Your Next, yes, it was made back in 2011. It didn't get a wide release until 2013. So let's get to Your Next. Yes. Because Your Next is a slasher movie, but it has this kind of, I don't even know how you describe the tone, because it's not winking. It's just, it has like, it's like sarcasm almost. Like
it is so much fun, and it shifts. It becomes kind of it takes the whole slasher film genre and it turns it inside out.
It takes the home invasion and like, what if the home invasion accidentally home invaded an action hero? Like, oops.
Yes.
Like unknowingly.
And Charney Vincent, man, what a hell of a leading lady. What a hell of a good scream queen. She is just phenomenal in this.
Yeah, her, and I really like the final scene with AJ Bowen too. I think he's phenomenal in that in the final.
A common theme. We love AJ Bowen. I think that's definitely we can gather that from this.
Even before it gets to kind of the action mode that it gets to towards the end.
The family stuff
is fantastic.
And it's awesome.
Which brings me to Joe Swanberg, who's amazing in this movie. He's the biggest dick of the group.
Feel so bad. When
you do feel bad.
Like everything that happens to him.
There's just the family dynamic that's set up, including Ty West, is like Amy Simons' boyfriend, right? Who's like a short filmmaker, and the kind of just seeing these relationships play, where you see Joe Swanberg giving Ty West shit, where like it's just the kind of fun that they seem to clearly be having of being like opposed to each other for no real reason. Just the instant comedic drama being set up as like any other kind of like holiday movie before all hell breaks loose and arrows start flying into the windows and killing people. It's
a lot of times horror movies will take really mean-spirited characters, and it's not fun to watch. It actually gets kind of infuriating. Here, there's something about it. It's so gleefully mean to each other that you kind of have a blast watching them, and you're having fun with them. As mean as they get to each other, it's still entertaining.
Which is impressive given a scene where Amy Simons is supposed to accomplish something, and it's filmed in slow motion, and there's a result that's darkly funny when it really shouldn't be.
Oh yeah.
Yes, exactly. What a great moment.
But what, so Jason, you've been asking all podcasts, you know, what the directorial stamps are of these people. What do you look at when you look at Wingard?
You know, I think what did I say at the beginning? I think it was very much like, you know, like an unpredictability. There's definitely, you know, the one thing I'm mixed on Your Next, because I think Your Next definitely has unpredictability, and that was the thing that I liked about it. But I think I had been spoiled, because I watched a movie prior to that called The Aggression Scale, and it kind of was like if Home Alone if the kid was a homicidal maniac. And so there was so many fun things that made that movie great. And so for Your Next, I think for me, why I had a problem with it was the Sherry Vincent character. Really, there was only a few things that she you know, infused into the movie, and the movie felt a little all over the place in terms of what it wanted to be, which can be okay if you want to use multiple things, but it didn't necessarily blend well together. I was a little taken aback. And also, I'm sorry, what's her name? Barbara Crampton. Who's great, by the way, this year in We Are Still Here. Yeah, she's great in that. I almost felt like she was kind of wasted in Your Next. I really didn't see a lot of why she needed to be in that movie. I didn't really use her that well.
Well,
so
I feel like it just felt like it was a casting win that they could get her to be in the movie. Just
But she can play a good... I mean, there's a lot of people who play good roles. I agree, AJ was great. Sherry's great, but I just feel like they needed to give her more. Like, it felt like it was very her contribution, for her character's contribution to what she was actually doing in the movie, felt sporadic. I felt like I wanted to see more concentration on that and get that audience into the fun of that character. Again, I had been spoiled with The Aggression Scale, so it felt like it was a little more spaced out. But definitely the unpredictability, you were talking about the Amy Simons moment, things like that, all definitely great, you know, the Ty West moment, all that stuff. That unpredictability, I think, as opposed to, say, signature style with the camera or the pacing or anything like that. That to me, what I think Adam Wingard, I think unpredictability.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree with you on some of these points, because Your Next, I do like Your Next quite a bit, but it wasn't one of my, like, I know there was like a lot of praise about Your Next when it was kind of leading up to its coming out, because it premiered a while back, and there's a lot of people that are praising it already because there's, you know, people had seen it, you know, years prior. They're like, finally, you guys get to see Your Next. I saw it, and I do enjoy the movie, but it's just not one that, like, I completely like throw myself down.
Well, they
down
kept
for.
Calling it like a game changer. It's gonna like, do what Cabin in the Woods did for this.
And I think I got slightly I think I got spoiled by that. I think I got a little bit overhyped by how much it's really trying to accomplish. I still did like it, especially when I started really tuning into what the tone would be. Because at first it's like, well, it just seems like a slasher movie. But it's like, oh, okay, there's some fun going on here. There's some aha moments I get that are going on that I kind of slowly realize. And I've watched it a second time since, and I still get the same kind of overall thought on it, where I still don't love the movie, but I do like it quite. I do admire what it's doing. but it does. It
well,
make,
it is. It's, yeah. It's interesting what you say. I saw it early. Mm-hmm. So I was already like, oh, this movie's great. This movie's awesome. And I think that can play a big part when you hear all the hype, when you get, oh, yeah, that's, I think we've discussed this before on this podcast. It kind of spoils you a lot because you're expecting, like you said, a game changer. And it's not necessarily a game changer, but it's so much fun.
There are some that deliver on that, though, where I think like the Babadook and It Follows are terrific movies. I think they're absolutely
cool. Oh, yeah, I agree with
that. But they didn't sit for years and every Halloween coming like, why are they not releasing this movie? Why are they not? Why'd they pick it up?
Yeah, but I didn't. I didn't sit around watching Your Next and hoping it would get real. I didn't know about Your Next until like that year when it was coming out.
Oh, I had read about it for a while, and I kept trying to see if there were bootlegs or something. I wanted to see the movie bad.
And what I'm saying is that I've known about. I feel like I knew about the Babadook the same amount of time I knew about Your Next in terms of the lead up to actually seeing both movies.
And it still worked.
And one really did deliver for me, where the other is like, all right, that was good. But so that, I mean, that's how I come at it. Same with It Follows to an extent. I had less of a lead up to actually seeing it versus, you know, the hype I was able to build around it. But I still walked away appreciating it a whole lot. I do like the masks.
Yes. And I think, that's one of the things they do, too, is like, what if the guys wearing the mask aren't as tough as they look with the masks, you know, because they're kind of bumbling when it comes to Sharni Vinson.
Oh, yeah. I actually have those masks hanging on my wall. Not kidding.
And that song at the that song at the beginning, by the way, is so addictive. I'll admit, I listen to that song like constantly on YouTube.
Really?
So, yeah.
Wow. I was like, okay, I've had enough. Yeah.
The song's fun, and you know what? I really like the end credits. The end credits that kind of, as they're going through the cast list, they go through what their state currently is while they go when they like go to each person's name, which kind of humors me a lot in that movie. Especially some of them like AJ Bowen and how things end up for his character. So you're like, you're seeing his image with his name plastered on. It's like, oh, that's what that looks like.
Looking for the magic. That's what it
was. Next film from Adam Wingard was from last year was The Guest, which is a movie I do love. I did come really excited for it, and I walked away really happy about seeing it. And this movie, which is one that I really don't even like describing too much because I don't like to kind of, it's not even like a spoiler because it's very much a movie that has a long build to what it tries to get to, but it's very much inspired by movies like The Terminator and Halloween which really don't lead you anywhere in terms of what you can expect to see from it, but at the same time perfectly kind of encapsulate what that movie is. But it has
a great soundtrack.
Great soundtrack. Great 80s soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Great soundtrack.
80s, like, synth and electronic soundtrack mixed with
a couple of great leading performances. Exactly. You have Dan Stevens and you have Micah Monroe. I mean, they really stepped it up for this movie. It's such a terrific film. But like you said, such a mix up of genres that you kind of don't even know halfway through. You're like, what is this? It's so addictive. Such a great film.
Yeah, it's, oh man, it's so good. There's like a lot of unpredictability. Like when you see like Ethan Embry in the movie, you're like, oh, what's he gonna do? Oh, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It's got some good brutality to it that's painful, but in good taste. Memorable, like the bar scene. Oh my gosh.
Oh,
because it's amazing. The movie, the thing that you'd really be clear on, it's really funny. Like, it's a movie that really delves into kind of, not even dark humor. I think there's some just straight comedy in here. Like, Leland Orser's entire part is being this dad who says funny things. Like, it's written that way. Lance Reddick is, like, Dr. Exposition in this movie, but he's kind of hilarious in that role. Just in the ways delivering lines and the kind of frustration he has with what he's trying to accomplish. And Dan Stevens as David, he gets just this great juicy role where you can't trust him right away you can't trust him because the title of the movie is called The Guest and it screams that title at you right away. So like you know you're in for something.
The title screen looks like The Exorcist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you know you're getting into something right away there. Like it's not trying to mask the fact that there's sinister things afoot, but it's just great to kind of slowly delve into what those reveals are going to be. And even in learning them, like the payoff is fine, but it's just seeing the kind of the kind of the reaction shots of why things are happening, or like how things have got to the point that they are at, and seeing how these characters respond to these things, that makes it really worthwhile.
And it's there's a beautiful simplicity to the movie that I just love. Like, it doesn't try to be some big statement or everything. It's just pure entertainment.
It's not their plot's not overcomplicated whatsoever.
No, it's not.
No.
I think I'm kind of like the odd man out on this movie, because it's a half and half for me. The lead up is really, really interesting and well done. But I felt like halfway through, I was like, this is where it led. And it kind of just went, I don't know. The second half really didn't do anything for me.
I've heard that argument.
It's funny you say that, because I was about to say, I love the ending of this so much. I think it's so much fun. Me and Jason always will find we agree on so much, and then we'll be like, but we'll go completely opposite on one movie. But it's okay. That's why we like each other.
Because one of the things specifically I remember about the beginning was this really, this love-hate interesting relationship between Dan and Micah. And I was fascinated by that, but it almost seemed like halfway through it just went and dropped. And I was like, wow, okay.
Well, yeah, because he's...
No, obviously. Right. And I get it. But it wasn't a good payoff for me. Like, I just felt like that second half just dropped. And I had seen that second half before. The whole first half is out to lunch. Like, you have no idea where it's going to go, what's going on. Get with the unpredictability, great, but it felt like that second half I'd seen before, so it dropped for me big time.
While I obviously can't like change your opinion on what to think about the second half, what I like about the second half, as far as kind of seeing elements of it before and other things or whatnot, I think there's an attitude that David has throughout the kind of that half of the movie, or the final act of the movie, or whatever you want to call it, where there's a whole kind of there's a frustration he has in his face where he doesn't feel he needs to do things a certain way, but it's like, well, I guess I got to get this done now. And he kind of rolls his eyes when he does certain actions, which includes tossing grenades at a certain point, which I just find to be absolutely hysterical. Like, that's what kills me about it, where it's like like in The Terminator or Michael Myers, there's no reaction from these things because they're emotionless things that are just killing people.
Yeah.
And there's other things around that obviously make those movies, fantastic. But with David, he's a person that has like a personality that goes with all the stuff that he's, kind of forcing himself to do. And that's what really got me for it. That's what made me kind of really enjoy the getting the results of what's going on, regardless of what the kind of reveal is in terms of what's truly going on with this person. It's a lot of vagueness I'm dancing around there, but I enjoy it. I got it.
I also think it's actually quite funny that Micah Monroe is kind of doing all these Halloween-inspired horror films.
Yeah.
It follows us so much. I mean, it follows as almost a Halloween remake without Michael Myers, if you think about it. There's scenes, literal scenes, that are just inspired by Halloween. And same with this, that last half feels very much like a Halloween film in a weird sort of way. It's strange, but it's funny. I like that. I love the Halloween love that these movies give.
And now she's going on to Independence Day 2.
Exactly. The scariest movie of them all. Okay, so we've gone through all these. We did it.
Yeah, we did it.
And Wingard, to attach him to Juan, was in consideration for the 8th Fast and Furious movie.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah, that's,
but now he's.
I think they should have. I think I wouldn't be surprised to see.
He would have been
He's gonna do
filmmaking wise. He would have been the most interesting choice of who they were going with, but I don't know if he would have been the right choice. Which I think they might. They probably made the right choice.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned about this. I Saw the Devil remake, though.
Unnecessary, but here we go.
Yeah.
People don't like to read subtitles. That's why you get it.
Wow.
It's currently attached to a Death Note American adaptation, whatever that's worth, which I'm curious about.
I think out of all the films that he's working on, the most I'm excited about is The Woods. I'd love to see what he would do to a quote unquote like an Evil Dead type or whatever it is. It doesn't really say, but whether it's a Friday the 13th or an Evil Dead. I love what he does to older horror movies, so who knows?
Maybe that one would be fun. These are the guys I wish they would call when doing like a new Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street. Could you imagine Ty West's touch?
It'd be great.
Absolutely.
there's no new ground on like Friday the 13th, so make that nostalgia trip vintage movie in the 80s and have Ty West do it. He knows what to do. Wingard would know what to do. Like a Ty West, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street on low, and these guys don't need huge budgets. They're doing this on no budget.
They don't.
But you know as well as I mean, he would be fantastic, but you know as well as I do, they would mess with that vision. If they're going to mess with Cabin Fever 2, they're going to mess with this Friday the 13th. I would love to see a Ty West unbridled, untouched, his version Friday the 13th would be friggin' fantastic.
He's perfect.
Can we start a writing campaign?
Do these guys get these opportunities, though? Like, do you think?
Well, I think Ty West had a bad experience with Cabin Fever 2, so he's hesitant to go back to a big studio film.
Yeah.
Wingard is apparently talking to big studios because he's, you know,
in contention for a lot of these things,
For Fear Escape. Yeah, these are the guys that they need to talk to for these, and they don't. I never see their names come up.
But I just wonder, like, do you think they want to? I guess
they've got to be fans. They've got to maybe have thought of like.
They got to be fans, but at the same time, don't you think they're? I mean, they're the kind of, they're like us essentially. They've grown up watching these movies. They just happen to actually do the things that, you know, we admire. And do you think that Ty West at some point was like, huh, they're gonna make another Nightmare on Elm Street, and maybe I can do something like that. I really like.
Because Ty West can do those and then go back to what he was doing.
I don't think
he'd look for it. But they, you know, if they were smart,
That's what I'm asking. Like, do you think?
No, he wouldn't go looking for that.
James Wan. Like, I get James Wan's had more success with actual studios, but do you think he's like, I really want to set out to remake a film that I've grown up loving? Like, I don't think that he's that.
No, that's not on Wan's agenda.
I don't think so.
No, but I mean, if you could convince like West or Wingard, those are the two I would go for. Like, they're low budget. You could probably like try to like give them control somewhat, and you know, I think they what we're looking for is their aesthetic, their because even if a studio would be like, oh, we need, you know, more kills here, they would be done in the Ty West or Adam Wingard aesthetic, for because that's usually where it comes from in those movies. I think the changes, like studio notes, they might piss them off while making the movie, but I don't think we would see the suffrage of it.
I guess that's what the next stage has to go then, right? In terms of how to make these remakes. I mean, because they're gonna do Nightmare again now, right? Like they announced
Nightmare again, but I mean, it is taken. It's gonna have been maybe 4 years to make a Friday the 13th movie. They've had one in production since 2012. And they still can't. Like, that makes no sense to me. Like, how hard is that?
And there's another Texas Chainsaw, right? I mean,
it's supposed to be in May. Yeah. I think May is the new date for Friday the 13th. They're not going to make that. They don't even have a film like ready to shoot. It's so bizarre. I figured when Paramount got rights to it for 5 years, they would have had at least 2 to 3 films out of that. But no.
Although you know what's funny? I'm just looking. We were talking about Ty West doing not doing a Friday the 13th, but he did do direct an episode of the Scream series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a bizarre choice. I could not get past the first episode. Maybe it's something I should look into if he directed one, but I did not like that.
I thought it was better than it had any business being. That was my fair judgment on that.
But yeah, but watching his episode, I couldn't really think like, man, this was really a Ty West episode. When I remember seeing that director's credit, like, huh, that's it. And then I was like, well, it's just another episode of Scream, but good I guess he got a paycheck for that one, so good on him.
Yeah, like that was one of those shows I watched the first episode, and I'm like, okay, all of the women are awful. All the guys are idiots. I have no desire to go any further. I think I've made it 15 minutes. So I'm like, nope. Not watching it.
But Brandon, you mentioned the Friday the 13th. Like, how has this not had a sequel or like had another film in years? Like that remake made money. Like it made a lot of money.
The Nightmare on Elm Street one killed it. They came out the following year, and that one did not do. And that one made money too. But
its expectations were a little bit hated.
It didn't make the money they wanted, and Friday the 13th Part 2 was canceled right after that. Although, I mean,
we're gonna see Friday the 13th. I think we're gonna see it probably
at the very end of that deal they made. We're gonna get one film at the very end of that deal we made, and then we won't see one again because once it goes back to joint rights, it's hard to make a movie because you have like a joint thing between three studios trying to make a Friday the 13th film.
Isn't it interesting that we go through all these Friday the 13th movies that are super cheesy and they still do well, but yet we update it and it just stinks, man. And it's like, geez, it doesn't. I mean, the bar is not set that high, but I think because we're doing it
they
now,
put
we're going
way
up to,
too
we're
much money.
The bar.
They're going to put $20+ million budget. You give someone 14, and although the reason we like those is because they didn't have money and people had to get creative. They had to do things on the spot, and that's what's so enjoyable. Now they just pumped way too much money into a slasher film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, that the whole point of those movies were it was cheap. They're cheap and fun. That's the way they should keep it.
Yep. That's what we like about them. That's where the soul is in them. And to bring it back, I mean, the Wingard West, those guys do this stuff for like way less money, and they could make
even
it
Wong,
just as
even
good
Wong's
and just as enjoyable.
A, you know,
yeah, they could make it just as good.
Insidious. Yeah,
they would make it look even more expensive on way less a budget and more
genuine
than any studio does. But they go with the Platinum Dunes, who God bless them. They try to be the Hammer horror of the OOs with slasher films and 70s and 80s horror, but most of their stuff is generally disliked. But this the way they go. The guys we're talking about are the ones that if you have a franchise, you should at least talk to them. They don't talk to them.
I agree. Yeah.
So where can we conclude with all this? Anything else we can say to bring it all back to into perspective of some kind?
I know.
For me, a good modern master has to be someone, if I'm going to watch their movies, has to be someone who draws my attention with something interesting, with something interesting to say. It doesn't even have to be new material, but I want a fresh face on something. I want something that I haven't seen a million times, or something that's infused with something great. And with Juan, he's got good stories, but obviously I have issues with Juan. Wingard, there's an unpredictability that I do like to his films. And West, no matter what subject he's tackling, he's bringing a signature style. I think that's why I would say out of all of the filmmakers, all of us, I think Ty West is probably the most impressive, because even on a small budget, and it's easy to go, these people have big budgets, you can do whatever. But here's a guy working on a low budget who has a fantastic signature style, takes time, creates great mood and style, and just an interesting movie. So it doesn't take money; it just takes passion and drive and a little something extra. So any modern master to me has to be someone who is going to differentiate themselves in some way, so that I'm eager to see what they're going to do next.
Yeah, Ty West, I think that as much as I love, House of the Devil and The Innkeepers, I still think we've got on the table, I don't think his best film's been made yet. His best horror film.
I wouldn't say so at all. No, he's in his early...
Right.
I think he's barely 30. He's got some movies to make.
Absolutely.
I feel like, Juan, maybe we've seen his best, and, I'm not going to pinpoint him that, but his catalog's big enough, and that maybe we've seen what he's got. And then Wingard, I just don't know. I think we're, I love The Guest. I like Your Next, but I don't know if he just keeps doing those or if he's got this like big one in the can. But I feel like one day it's going to click and he's going to have something just remarkable.
Well, not that Wingard, that he needs a studio to suddenly be amazing, but I mean, he is dancing around like taking on some higher profile projects. So I mean, certainly something to look forward to there in terms of him spreading out into a wider center of appeal and seeing, where things go with that. West, I agree. I mean, it's like, dude's got a clear signature style to him. So it'd be neat to see, what he comes up with over the, next few years or whenever. And then, Juan, guy's a success story. I mean, he's doing everything he
seems
to want to do at this point. So
good for him. Good for him.
With that, I mean, we're going along here. So we managed to do this, actually. It's pretty close to the last episode. But so we've done it. We've talked about all three directors. Abe, how are you doing?
Oh, man. I'm never going to see House of the Devil, but you guys make me really want
to
see it.
You should see House of the Devil, Abe. I think you dig House of the Devil.
You should.
Well, the way that you guys have described that scene where it's like, you know that something's going to be in there, but it's kind of weird, and it's like, I'm alone in my house. It's kind of dark. I don't know if I'm going to go to sleep that well if I go look up the scene.
You should watch House of the Devil and the Innkeepers. Innkeepers, yeah, especially. Innkeepers is like a lot of fun. Like there's a lot.
I looked at the poster while you guys were talking. Pretty neat poster.
Oh, for House of the Devil, you're talking about
for both
Innkeepers.
For both,
yeah, both of them.
Oh yeah, both. Yeah. Yeah. His posters
House
are usually
the devil
good.
Is old school.
The Sacrament has a cool poster also.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Anyway, that's it. We've done this. We've done this episode. It's in the can.
Yep.
Let's get out of here. How next week's show? Next week we're going to be talking about Sam Raimi, and not just Sam Raimi. We're going to be doing an audio commentary for Army of Darkness. There's a number of reasons why. Let me get into this. So to jump back a few years, Brandon and I, in addition to Jordan and Abe, we did commentaries for Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2: Dead by Dawn. So we have those going. Obviously, we need to finish that trilogy. So there's one thing. Another thing. Army of Darkness just released a very special Scream Factory 3-disc edition Blu-ray of Army of Darkness. It's wonderful. It's a great thing.
It's outstanding.
Yes,
it is good.
We have a brand new transfer of the director's cut, and the international cut's now on Blu-ray, among other goodies that are in there. But there's a brand new gorgeous looking film to watch. The third thing, Ash versus the Evil Dead premieres next week. So. In addition to us doing a filmmaker spotlight where we can incorporate Sam Raimi, another person who very much belongs in this discussion of people that we could talking about, everything seems to be lining up for us to be able to finally do an Army of Darkness commentary, which is also going to be our commentary of the month. So lots of things to be happy about there. One thing, I get to talk with all you guys about Army of Darkness, which is awesome, and we get to talk about Sam Raimi in general, who I think is an awesome filmmaker. So that is the plan for next week's episode.
We will be doing the TV cut.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. but yeah, that should be fun. I'm looking forward to doing that. But for now, let's just wrap things up here. Let's start with Brandon. Brandon, where can people find more of your work online?
Cult Cinema Cavalcade, cultcinemacavalcade.com. New episodes every other Monday. And Twitter, at BT Peters.
Jason Coleman.
Yes, you can catch any writings I do on starpulse.com. And of course, Jimmy and I do. And what's interesting is Sam Raimi has worked into two of our big events. We did an Evil Dead festival, and we did a Lethal Ladies of Horror Film Festival, which featured Drag Me to Hell. So we're big Raimi fans, and you can catch events that we do at facebook.com/flicksforfans.
Jimmy O.
Yeah, you can find me at joeblow.com, arrowintheheadcom, Instagram, Facebook, yada yada, everywhere. Even Periscope. So there you go.
Abe, are you on Periscope?
I am not on Periscope, but you can find Jimmy on Periscope. And you can find Aaron at Rant Hollywood.
Yeah, you can find me at Rant Hollywood writing about movies daily. You also follow me on Twitter at Aaron's PS4. You can find these other horror bonuses and all of our episodes about Out There and Abe on iTunes and at Audio Boom. You can email us outnowpodcast@gmo.com. Let us know your thoughts on the modern filmmakers of today in the world of horror. Facebook page, facebook.com/outnowpodcast, Twitter, outnow_podcast. Got all that stuff. You know how to find our show. I've been having a lot of fun doing these guys. This is a lot of fun tonight. You guys have fun?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
Abe, did you feel like you learned something?
I've learned a lot, actually.
Okay. Well, with all that said, until next time we talk about Sam Raimi in Ash versus the Army of Darkness, that's going to do it for this week's episode. So long.
And goodbye. All my life I love you.